of 15 to 20 million
jobs.
I am your future.
Isn't it about time for a change?
We're our national leaders.
AmericanWorkersRadio.com.
You're listening to American Workers Radio, a national network promoting American-made products with your host, Michael Blihash.
Well, welcome once again to another edition of American Workers Radio here on 860 AM. In Philadelphia and serving the entire tri-state area of southeastern Pennsylvania, the state of New Jersey, and northern Delaware. However, we reach around the United States and around the world simply by going to our internet site, AmericanWorkersRadio.com, and click on the Listen Live link. If you received a email from us this morning, why not send it off to a family member or friend and get them involved in the movement? It's really starting to get bigger, better, and more realistic each and every week that we are broadcasting and uniting family and friends behind what we're trying to do. Also, if you have someone in the family and they need some kind of information or referral about what's taking place in the American-made movement, ask them to visit us on AmericanWorkersRadio.com, where you will find many links that outline what we're trying to do. And I'll be talking about our effort coming up in November, which is not that far away. It'll be, in fact, the first show of November as American-made month next Wednesday. Our panel is all on board. Mark Andel, founder of the Made in America store. Larkin Conley, who is a small business advocate and SCORE mentor. Rich Logis, principal of RJL Technology Integration. And of course, our engineer is Henry Chaplinsky, and I'm Michael Blihash. Always pleased to be with you. Well, in the last few weeks, we had a very special guest, Curtis Ellis. He's the executive director of the American Jobs Alliance. And he joined us to really give us some very deep information, some information that we needed to hear, and some information that we shared with our listeners. We had a tremendous amount of people coming up onto our internet site to listen to our broadcast. And I want to thank Curtis for also sending out his links to his newspapers and friends, various shows that we've had on the radio. Mr. Ellis is with us again today. He's been working. He's done a tremendous job. You know him firsthand as a person who worked in the United States Congress, and he's worked on many campaigns, as he mentioned, over the weeks. He served as a senior policy advisor for President Donald Trump and is once again in the news as the person who wrote the article on NAFTA and outsourcing. And I'm going to ask Curtis to open up the broadcast today. And I'm going to then ask our panel members, Rich, Mark, Larkin, and myself, to join this discussion. Curtis, tell us about your article with NAFTA and outsourcing, because it really affects all of the American workers in the USA.
Yeah, it certainly does. President Trump, when he was candidate Trump, had promised for the first time in a long time, we heard a candidate of a major political party talking about NAFTA and the bad impact it's had on American workers. You may remember many years ago, Ross Perot talked about NAFTA. That's when it was being negotiated back in 1992. It was a campaign issue, and Ross Perot talked about the giant sucking sound. What would happen to jobs in America? They would be sucked down to Mexico, where even today, now 25 years later, the average wage with benefits and everything for a Mexican worker is $2.50 an hour. So how do you compete with that? Well, the fact of the matter is, as Donald Trump has pointed out, American businesses have a hard time competing with that, and we've lost entire industries to Mexico. And he vowed that if he were elected, we would renegotiate this and get a better deal for Americans. And that's exactly what's happening. Right now, NAFTA is being renegotiated. U.S. Trade Representative Ambassador Robert Lighthizer is leading the negotiations, and he is a smart, tough, experienced negotiator and trade representative. He worked in the Reagan administration, and he believes in the Donald Trump America First philosophy, and he's not naive, and he's not an economic neophyte. He understands how business works as well as how politics works and how negotiation works. The United States has put forward and given notice to Mexico and Canada that four of the main proposals that we're asking for, and Bob, by the way, Bob Lighthizer is not alone in this. U.S. Secretary of Commerce Wilbur Ross is backing him up and has come up with these four proposals. Wilbur Ross is a billionaire, an investor, owns manufacturing companies. He is not, again, just some lawyer or some politician. This is a guy who is a very well respected in the business community and on Wall Street, and has experience in international trade and manufacturing and all manners of business, various sectors. The four proposals that are put forward that the United States put on the table for the new NAFTA, or NAFTA 2.0, if you want to call it, is number one. We need to change what are called the rules of origin. Right now, for an automobile to be imported into the United States under the preferential tariff treatment of NAFTA, some 62% of it must be made within North America, within the three countries. We're proposing that be raised to somewhere in the 80% range, and a higher percentage of that must be in the United States. Not, I don't mean higher than 80%, but higher than what's currently required. Right now, you could say have brake shoes made in China, and they could be imported into Mexico, incorporated into that car, and then the car gets low tariffs when it's imported into the United States. We want to make sure that more of these NAFTA cars are made in the NAFTA countries. Over the 25 years that NAFTA has been in existence, we've seen an increasing percentage of the content of these cars coming from outside the NAFTA zone. And that's not good for the American worker, not good for the Mexican worker or the Canadian worker. There's been a huge change in the automobile industry. You didn't have smart cars. You didn't have cars with onboard computers. You didn't have there's whole new technological developments that didn't exist 25 years ago that need to be taken into account when we say, where are these cars being sourced? Where are the parts being made? So that's one. Number two, we wanted to see a higher, a stronger Buy American provision. There's aspects in NAFTA which undercut any Buy American policies. Let's say a state or the United States wants to enforce the laws that have been on the books since the 1930s, requiring that when the U.S. government purchases goods and services, American taxpayers are first in line, American businesses are first in line when taxpayer dollars are being spent. These provisions have been watered down in NAFTA, and we want to strengthen them again. Particularly, what happens is there's a chapter on government procurement. Basically, we give every country in NAFTA, Mexico and Canada, are treated as if they were American companies when it comes to government procurement. So U.S. government wants to buy something, and it falls into the Buy American provision. Well, it can buy Mexican or it can buy Canadian. And that's how we see the Border Patrol uniforms. The uniforms our Border Patrol agents wear are made in Mexico. And they're not made in the United States, even though the Berry Amendment says that that Homeland Security needs to buy American. Well, because of the NAFTA rules, the way they're written now, Mexico is treated as if it's an American company. In exchange, we, the United States companies, American companies, are given the same opportunity to bid on projects and purchases and procurement when the Mexican government buys goods. If they have a Buy Mexican provision, American companies are treated as if they're Mexican. And Canadian companies, same way, which, by the way, Canada is very, very protectionist and has very strict local content and national content rules. But American companies are allowed to participate and bid on these projects because of the NAFTA rules. However, there's one little catch. The United States government probably spends 1,000 times more than the Mexican government or the Canadian government, as you could imagine. So we've opened up our market, which the United States government spending $17 trillion, right? The U.S. budget is like $1.2 trillion. We're opening that up wide to all the Mexican and Canadian companies. And the Canadian and Mexican governments are spending, you know, let's say a fraction of that in their budget. And so it's not a reciprocal and it's not a fair arrangement. What Wilbur Ross and Bob Lighthizer have said is, look, on this government procurement stuff, we're going to cap it. How much are the Mexicans and the Canadians spending? Well, that's how much they get. That's how big a piece of the pie they get of the American government procurement, which seems pretty reasonable and fair. Two other major points that they're proposing is, one is the investors, I don't want to get into the gobbledygook here, but something called investor state dispute settlement, which is basically if a company or a country of Mexico or Canada or one of the company's investors in there has a beef about how they're being treated under NAFTA, they don't take it to a United States court. They don't take it to a Mexican court. They take it to an international tribunal, which consists of three corporate lawyers, which are appointed in a less than transparent fashion. And that tribunal can overrule American laws, can award damages to the companies that are then paid for by U.S. taxpayers. It's setting up an extrajudicial system outside the purview of the United States court system, and it effectively is subsidizing companies and threatening subsidizing foreign companies, because American companies don't have access to this. Let's say an American company has a beef with the way business is done in the United States. They can't go to one of these panels. But if a foreign company has a beef about how business is done in the United States, they get to go outside of the U.S. court system and go to this weirdo kangaroo court system that's set up. So it's a separate but unequal court system that gives a competitive advantage to foreign investors over U.S. investors. Well, what we're saying, we being the Trump administration, Wilbur Ross and the United States government, is saying this little system, it's got to end. It will make it voluntary. You can opt in if you choose, but it's not mandatory. And then finally, probably the most important point being made in the proposal is a sunset clause. Ronald Reagan once said there's nothing as permanent as a temporary government program. Well, He it was onto something there. No business ever writes a contract that exists in perpetuity. Every contract comes up for renewal. Every contract has an end point to it, is renegotiated. Whether it's a lease on your house, on your business, or it's how much you're going to pay your supplier, or how much how long you're going to be selling your goods to your customer. They get to check in every few years and make sure it's working right. Well, that's not how our trade agreements are written. They just exist forever, and the terms are there forever. Well, that's going to change under the U.S. proposal. In 5 years, it would sunset, and we get to renew it. And you can either opt in or call for a renegotiation. Well, what happened is these talks were supposed to, they were expected to wrap up this year. But when we put these proposals on the table in good faith, the Canadians and the Mexicans rejected them, as did the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and most of the huge global corporate interests that ruled the roost in Washington, the Canadians and the Mexicans rejected them out of hand. They said, oh, we can't do this. And so in response, Ambassador Lighthizer, the U.S. Trade Representative, said, well, let's take a timeout on talks. We're not going to meet again next week or next month. Let's think about it for a while. As a result of that, and as a result of what's on the books, the statutory requirements for congressional review, this, assuming the agreement assuming there's an agreement made, well, anyway, the negotiations are now stretching into next year. They're not going to be wrapped up this year. They're going to stretch into next year. And what happens next year? Next year we have these things called midterm elections. We have primaries where the Republican Party and the Democratic Party choose their candidates in open primaries. And then we have the general election in November. Well, under the statutory requirements of congressional review, Congress has to review and vote on whatever new NAFTA agreement is finally agreed upon. That vote will come within days of the November election. So this NAFTA and talking about Buy America and putting American first and the interests of American workers and American businesses, and are we being served by these trade agreements? Are we being served by these international tribunals that threaten our sovereignty, that disadvantage our businesses? Are we being served by watering down Buy American provisions and giving up our trillion-dollar government market for a shot at a much smaller pie in Mexico and Canada? These will all be debated now in the context of an election, and does the man who wants to, or woman who wants to represent you in Congress, where do they stand on this? These will now be issues in an election year, and this is the dreaded nightmare of the globalists and of supporters of these phony free trade agreements, which are neither free nor trade. They always try to get this stuff done in the off years, sweep it under the rug so people have forgotten about it by the time the election comes around. And how do I know this? Well, that's what they've always done. They debated NAFTA in 93. They tried to get the Trans-Pacific Partnership done in 2015. They did the Korea Free Trade Agreement in 2011, the odd number of years, because they know this is pure political poison. American people are wise to the game. They know these trade agreements are not trade agreements. They're labor arbitrage agreements. They're outsourcing agreements. They're so the giant global corporations can move their operations offshore to the cheap labor havens, whereas smaller American companies don't have that option. So they are at a distinct disadvantage when they have to hire Americans. The businesses can move their operations offshore to the cheap labor havens, cheap work camps, cheap labor camps. American people can't move to where the jobs are. We have a mortgage. We have a house. We have a culture. We have a neighborhood. We have families here in the United States. We can't go chasing the jobs the way the Fortune 50 companies can chase the cheapest labor on earth. So we're at a disadvantage here. This will all be debated because what we saw in 2016, we saw this movie in 2016. For the first time, Donald Trump made it an issue. He made these trade deals an issue in the campaign. That's why he won Pennsylvania. That's why he won in Ohio and Wisconsin and Michigan. And that's why he became president of the United States against all the odds and all the predictions of the elite Washington Beltway crowd who said it would never happen. So now we're going to see a replay of this next year. Thank goodness. We're actually going to have a real debate about these trade agreements and about NAFTA, the new NAFTA. And the candidates are going to have to answer that question that was put to the miners in Harlan County, Kentucky in 1931. Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on?
You know, I want to tell you something, Curtis. I think it's the right timing for this to hit the fan. I really do. I don't think the elected people, we spoke last week that the people running for office should get out into their communities, number one, and actually physically see the people, talk to the people, shake hands. Well, this is an issue that should make them get off their butts and get into the community to see what the people really have to think and say. Because you go into some of these towns where the businesses are buttoned up, it's heartbreaking to see it. Knowing that those businesses are still in businesses, their label are still on the shelf in the store, but they're no longer made in America. Who agreed to the NAFTA agreement in the USA? Our congressmen and senators, right?
Mm-hmm.
So now it's up to, I applaud President Trump for doing this and people like yourself for pushing it, because if we don't put it on the table now, it'll just lollygag along until there's no other way to just let it get swept under the rug. The election time is a time just like this primary time when Trump was running with all the other candidates, and the election time, it's now the time for people to see really what their candidates are all about. With that, I am going to turn first today to Rich Loges. Rich, what did you think of our great guest's remarks?
How you doing, Michael? Good morning, guys. Curtis and our listeners. Curtis, thanks so much for being on. I really appreciate it. I think this is a really fascinating exercise, what's happening, what's going to happen in the next few years. On the old adage, we've talked about that politics is sales. And successful companies give their consumers and their end users what they want. And small business and American workers do not want any longer global trade deals. We know that they don't work long term. We know that had the election gone differently, the presidential election, remember, Curtis, that candidate Hillary Clinton, when she was Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, cited on 47 different occasions that TPP was the gold standard of trade deals. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, 47 times. So I think 47 times is enough times to know if you meant it or not. So, of course, she didn't really mean it when she said that she wouldn't enact the TPP. So we know that had the election gone a different way, we'd be looking at NAFTA on steroids. And, you know, NAFTA is just three countries, right? It's ourselves, Mexico, and Canada. TPP had, I believe it was a dozen countries in it. So what it was like Obamacare, it was from chaos, we'll have order. And what the TPP would have done, which is actually the most frightening aspect of it all, in my opinion, is we would have given away more of our economic sovereignty than we even did with NAFTA. Fact. Am I kind of on the right path?
Oh, you're absolutely right. I was just reading something today this from Stratfor, which is a strategic research firm, and the TPP was like the European Union in that it was creating this economic integration package, the free flow of people, goods, and money among the member countries, which is exactly what the European Union does. What I was reading today, which is interesting, is that the Asians have a different view of globalization than the Europeans. The Europeans are all on board. They're total globalists because of the European Union, where the national identities and the national economies and the national sovereignty of those countries in Europe has been subordinated to the European Union. Asia countries, and there's, you know, several different transnational organizations in Asia, but they all respect the national identities of the Asian countries. Trans-Pacific Partnership would have changed that. It was the first step and a major step toward mitigating or ameliorating our sovereignty.
And here we are 25 years after NAFTA, and when I looked the other day as I was preparing my information for November American Made Month, I took a look at the debt clock. And I think this is something we're going to have to discuss with the national elected people who are going for re-election. And that is, you know, America has right now 325 million people. Back in 2000, we had 283 million people, and any successful economy should be able to have its adults employed, full-time or part-time. In the year 2000, we had 135 million people employed, guys and girls. We really needed 170 million jobs, but we didn't have it. There was a huge gap between what we need. And who am I talking about when I looked at all those reports? I'm not talking about the youth, 18 to 1 year old, or those 65 years old, or out of the workforce, or the disabled. I'm talking about working age and able-bodied people who could be working as they were 45 years ago, when the nation had almost a 90% working rate for its working age and able-bodied people. Back in the year 2008, as these NAFTAs and all continued, America had 305 million people, and only 143 million of those were working. We really need about 170 million people. So we were way off the mark as far as that goes. Here we are today, Curtis, and we have 325 million people, and we have exactly, if you look on the debt clock, I'm not giving statistics that don't really exist. We have 326 million people, 154 million Americans have full and part-time jobs. In order for us to reach that plateau for working age and able-bodied people to have a job, we need 196 million full and part-time jobs. Don't the people in Washington see that we're sponsoring all sorts of welfare programs and things that keep people with a few dollars in their pocket, but they're not helping the economy nor the American worker? How is that possible?
Really, and you're hitting on a good point here, in that it's been shown, and this again by some Wall Street guys, not some raving liberals or some, you know, weirdo, you know, protectionists or something, but responsible, respectable Wall Street analysts, that if you raise the labor force participation rate and you have more Americans working and therefore paying taxes, spending money, you eliminate the deficit. The deficits at the local, state, and federal level disappear when you get more people working. The Social Security Trust Fund becomes solvent because you have people paying into it. You have more people paying more into it. And again, if people are earning $70,000 a year rather than $20,000 a year, they're paying more into the trust fund. So this is what's behind President Trump's America First tax reform proposal and his whole platform during the campaign, which he says, we're going to put Americans back to work. We're not going to touch Social Security. We're not going to cut Social Security. We're going to be able to eliminate the deficits and pay down our debt by putting Americans back to work. It's a very simple equation. You can either, if you're household budget doesn't balance, you can either cut spending, you know, dress your kids in rags, don't go around barefoot, or you can get a job. You can get a better paying job. So it works the same on a national level. We can eliminate the deficit by either cutting spending everywhere and don't, you know, forget about fixing the roads, forget about fixing the water system so people can't drink the water in Flint anymore, or you can put people back to work so they're paying into the coffers that'll pay for all those things.
There's one more thing I wanted to mention. In my study, I see that a large number of those millions, and there are several million people that are working, but it's called what they call the under table workers, people
right.
who come in. I'd like to see all of those put on the payroll especially those who have the possibility to stay in America without any further difficulty. Get everybody on the table that should be on the table, and let's move. You know, even the restaurant people say, I don't feel good about seeing this guy walk out the door with cash in his hands, knowing that 15 or 20 years from now, he's not able to apply for anything. He's going to get no Social Security. I'd rather see him on the table. Let's get everybody with a green card. Let's get everybody where we are proud to be an American and proud to be working in America.
Yeah, absolutely right. This is the reason why the big corporations, the big transnational global corporations, they like cheap labor. They don't have a problem with illegal immigration. They don't have a problem with unlimited, unrestricted immigration of all kinds. These guest worker programs, H-1B visas, etc., brings in cheap labor. If somebody's here illegally, they're not going to ask for higher wages. They get paid under the table. They can get paid far less than what you would pay an American when you have to start paying into Social Security, Medicaid taxes, and everything else. So they're taking advantage of it. They like it, and they cover it up. And this is something that, by the way, the founder of the American Federation of Labor, Sam Gompers, wrote about this in like 1900. He was fighting. He was the founder of the big labor union of the day. And he was fighting to restrict immigration. At that time, the 1890s was the last huge wave of immigration into this country, Ellis Island and all that. And he was saying what's happening is the big corporations are bringing in people to undercut the wages of Americans. And they're finding allies in the steamship companies, which were selling, you know, you saw Titanic, right? Steerage and, you know, Kate Winslet and Leonardo DiCaprio in the bottom deck, right? They were bringing people over by the boatload, literally. And the other allies that they found were, he called them the sentimentalists. The people saying, oh, the poor people, oh, we've got to open up our borders to everybody in the world, you know. And they were just being used, these sentimental, oh, the dreamers, oh, the this, oh, the that, oh, the poor huddled masses, we've got to give them refuge in our country, but please not in my apartment and not in my neighborhood. Those sentimentalists were being used by the big business interests who were just interested in cheap labor. But so this is an old debate. It's been going on forever. And, you know, we've seen this movie before. And the same way with this business with the government procurement issues in NAFTA, we've opened up our government procurement market worth literally $1 trillion. And in return, we get a shot at a market that's worth maybe $100 billion. That's not fair. And it's also an example of what we've done with all of our trade agreements in a larger sense. We give these countries open access to the U.S. market, which is the richest consumer market in the world. We've got more spending power and more money floating around and changing hands and people buying things in this country than any other place on earth. They get a free shot at this. And they get to sell their goods here. And what in return is we get access to the Mexican market or to the Vietnamese market. People in Vietnam live on about $1 a day. I mean, how much are we going to sell them? And you hear the Chamber of Commerce and the people saying, well, 98% of consumers live outside the borders of the United States. We must have these free trade agreements. Yeah, well, 98% of those consumers outside the United States of America live on $1 a day. And actually, a lot of them live on less than that. They grow their crops. They walk behind the water buffalo, and they feed the water buffalo. They feed the water buffalo grass. They're not even buying gas for a tractor, you know. And I visited villages like this. They live on a non-monetized economy. So probably a good 3 to 4 billion of the Earth's population live without money. So we're opening our market and giving away access to the U.S. market, and in return, we get access to that market. Well, it's one thing if you're dealing with Europe, one thing if you're dealing with, you know, Canada, one thing if you're dealing with the other developed countries. It's another thing when you start talking about these tiny pin-sized countries with a market that's not even the size of Cincinnati. It's not reciprocal. It's not fair.
You know, Curtis, you're absolutely right. And I'm glad all of this is hitting the fan because we've been talking about getting this off the spaceship mounter for a long time. And it's taken people like yourself and President Trump. I'm going to turn to Larkin Connolly, who is very interested to get involved.
Hey, Michael. Good morning. And Mark, Rich, Henry with your Eagles team and all the rest of that. Good morning, Curtis. Good morning. Thanks for being on again.
Good morning, Larkin.
You know, I usually when I listen to this, my score mentoring hat comes out. When I visit a small business, and I was with about 12 of them last night, counting husbands and wives, and it's a program that we have at SCORE and the Community College of Philadelphia where we take communities and we do block development, we do community development, we bring in all of the retailers, we dissect their business, we give them a practical quote-unquote MBA, and you know, help them recover or improve or grow sales or whatever it is they need to do. And you'd be amazed at how many of these entrepreneurs have the spirit but don't have the cash. And so this block work that we do, it's called Power Up at the Community College. When I talk to these people, you see the smoke. Sometimes you even see the flame. But in order to get down to brass tacks, you really have to tear everything apart and go down to the basement of the business and start your way up. And this is what I've always wished that Trump would do. This is what I hoped was the definition of draining the swamp, partially draining the swamp. We know it's a little bit more. You remember when I said at Christmas time on my Christmas list this year, I wished that Donald Trump was a president of the United States and that he would be a traditional president when he had to be a traditional president. And he would be a non-traditional president when he could get away with it and make changes. And unfortunately, he hasn't gotten to that presidential timber side of the act yet. Unfortunately, he has one gear right now. but you know, I don't have a lot of problems with what he's saying. Here's what I will say, though. As you take a look, I'll put a ribbon on this package that Curtis has handed to us this morning, and Mark, or Rich, and I'll say, you go down to the very base issue here. We don't have a problem in this country that we can't solve with J-O-B-S, jobs. We have got to put America back to work, and when you show me an international trade agreement that doesn't put us first, period, amen, first, put our people back to work, then I don't think it's a job agreement that serves us.
Well said, Larkin. And, you know, as you were mentioning earlier, Curtis, those people that are saying they're quitting Congress or whatever, well, good riddance. Because if they had any brass, they would be speaking up in behalf of jobs for Americans from the day they walked in the door. When I listened to some of them when they were campaigning originally for the jobs, everything for the job to be in Washington, everything was, we got to make America great and this and that. Here they are years later. They did nothing. This may be the greatest opportunity to put all the stuff on the table and let's get moving forward again. Mark Andel.
Mark, just let me stick in here. Let's get Jeff Flake and Bob Corker to leave a top 10 hit list of things that need to be done by Congress, because they sure as heck have not addressed 1 through 10 themselves. It's all it's none of it's substance. It's all the pictures. It's all, well, he said SOB. And
yeah,
he said
all that crap. Oh, my, have mercy. You know, Curtis, that's a good thing. Larkin, you said they should give their top 10 list of what should be done in America. Forget all the nonsense. Let's move forward.
Really, I want to hear Mark, but I just got to drop this in here. Jeff Flake, when he was there emotionally, you know, whining and tears were flowing and liquid was flowing from everywhere on his body when he was on the floor of the Senate yesterday. He said, "It is clear at this moment that a traditional conservative devoted to free trade and pro-immigration has a narrower and narrower path to nomination in the Republican Party," to which I say, amen.
Yes, absolutely. And if you don't understand that, go talk to Bannon. He'll give you his explanation.
Mark Andel.
How you doing, guys? Welcome, Curtis, again, and always great to hear from you, your knowledge and expertise, and Rich, Larkin, Henry. Mike, I heard Larkin, you've got a Phillies shirt on there or something like that.
Studio, by the way. When the
studio,
door opened at 10 of...
Somewhere in Philly.
He's in Philadelphia for another conference. I'll tell you, this guy really loves to move around, Larkin. And I'm gonna give you my job. I'm going to take yours.
Well, I'd like to say, doesn't have to work, ask Mark Andel, because, you know, again, I lost $3.5 million account to China directly in 2010, of course, and... you know, I always think of Bob Chesbro, and I know, Curtis, you had possibly known him through the Wigwam Sox, and he always said no trade deal worked. They gave every job in the textile industry away, which was my job that I fed my family with. You know, and I think of when I met the president of Caterpillar. Now, Caterpillar is produced, they're manufactured in 46 different countries. Caterpillar is one of the top leading excavation equipment companies in the world, and I had the pleasure of meeting him a couple of years ago in San Antonio, Texas, where they played the movie, and I came out in a background, and they took me to their 1 million square foot plant, and Caterpillar, you know, was trying to get back instead of country of consumption to the continent of consumption, which you kind of, you know, where logistically it made more sense. But they started here in the United States of America, great company. But again, you know, it's not a fair playing field. And Curtis, you know, I just back you on everything you had said today. And guys, I don't know if you guys got a chance to open the Washington Examiner article I sent you. It released last night at midnight. It was done by Scott Paul and Vincent Vitaro. Basically, it's a, you know, can we make things in America anymore? And it's a great article just released. You know, Scott Paul, head of the American Manufacturer Association out of Washington, and then Vincent Vitaro was the Life is My Movie producer-owner. And they interviewed him, and basically it talked about the 2000, tens of thousands of American factories closed. We know that. Millions of American factory jobs disappeared. It talks about how we're moving in the right direction, even over under Obama and Trump, and 1 million, you know, factory jobs created. But generally, it talks about the answer at the end of the article is yes, we can build things here. And it talks about how rooting for factory work and made in America isn't just a nostalgic thing. It's
right.
It's not a political statement. It's recognition of the strength of our nation. But entrepreneurs that you support, Larkin, and Ingenuity, and all the resources we have, we can build the next gadgets. We can get the rocket ships to Mars. We've got to build it. Washington wanted his uniform made here. George Washington, you know, Lincoln wanted the tracks made here and installed here in the steel from here. This is nothing new, but this article is a great release. And again, Larkin, like you meeting with these entrepreneurs, the number one problem is capital. The Dodd-Frank Act of 2010 killed it. I've been 32 years in business. You can't get a dollar out of a bank. If you have a million, you could possibly get a couple dollars. They made it so hard for entrepreneurs and inventors to get money and capital out of banks. Number one problem. And again, it's just this article hits it on. I've got a commissioning of the Little Rock, a Navy ship that was produced up in Wisconsin, coming out December 8th, being commissioned in Buffalo. First time ever. Great story. You talk about a manufacturing marvel made by the United States of America. It does 45 knots. It's 400 foot long. It's half steel horizontally on the bottom, aluminum on top. It's one of the lightest battleships and the best battleships. We can make and design anything. We just have to put the energy in. So everything you guys are talking about, we know it's real. We just got to keep this after. And I hope President Trump is the man of his word, and he's making that difference and changes these trade agreements. Wipe out our jobs and our neighbors' jobs. We have to do this, and I think we've got the right man in place.
You know, we have a caller that I wanted to get on. Most of the time, you know, we all lean in the same direction, some of us a little harder to the right or the left than others. But I think it's great that we hear qualifying remarks from some of our listeners. And we have Bruce on the line. Bruce, are you there?
I'm here.
Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you.
Wonder if we could have a comment or two from you.
Well, not as used to public speaking as Curtis is and you guys. I can tell by my accent I'm an outsider. I'm I take a very different point of view than you guys, most of you guys, as to what globalism means and what globalism is. Somebody who has been in business in this country and has had jobs in this country, formed a company here. Yes, I imported goods for many years. I also exported goods. And I have been all around the world observing, you know, how things are. And I think that the biggest mistake that you're all making is that, to trash what is called globalism, I call it free trade, quid pro quo for making jobs in this country is just not true. The one thing that I completely disagree with is that other countries are being unfair to the United States. That is just not true. Anybody who's ever been over to Europe or Asia, and I don't know how many villages Curtis visited, but I visited hundreds. I went to Jakarta, Indonesia, in about 1983, and there were 3 skyscrapers there. There are now well over 3,000 skyscrapers there. I don't know whether those people are poor and not wanting to buy American goods, but they are. If you go to Europe, Asia, anywhere, every street corner, there's a McDonald's. If you go into supermarkets, half the goods have got Heinz, Procter & Gamble, all the names that you know here. You go in a supermarket here, you don't find many English brands. You don't find any French brands. You don't find any Taiwanese brands. All the branding is done overseas, and that is part of America's projection to the world. For every McDonald's that's out there, that's dollars that come back to America. And it could be jobs. The failure that happened in this country was to not match the free trade agreements with creating jobs over here. And there's no question of doubt that we need jobs. I'm like Larkin. I work with SCORE. I work with small businesses. And I try and help businesses export because that's my expertise, if you like. But if there's no quid pro quo, if we're going to just isolate ourselves, then we will do more damage to the United States than we will to anybody else. There's no question doubt about that. It's all a question of balance. And you can't trash all free trade agreements and expect this country to thrive, because it won't.
I don't think anyone is arguing that trade agreements are good, but they have to really reflect the countries that are involved. If everybody has a quarter into the system, well, then that's fine. But in America's case right now, America's not printing. I'm looking at books. Everything is being printed outside of America. Why is that? Because if 50% were done in America, I could say, well, that's okay. We're allowing free trade. We're going back and forth. But the thing is, we have all of those products coming into America and very few products leaving America to go to many countries. Not all, but many countries do not feature many American-made products because we don't have a lot of American-made products made here.
Well, the American defense industry is the largest industry in the world. About three-quarters of the British Royal Air Force are going to be flying American planes. I don't see you buying French tanks or
and
German.
I agree with that, Bruce. I agree with that, but there's also one...
We buy all your defense goods.
But there's also... those are big-ticket items. We need to get all of the little... ticket items too, the people that work in the communities close to their homes. Yes, everybody cannot work for the big companies, but we also have to support our small workers. And this is where the people are disturbed with the way things have gone in America. I go to many stores shopping. I'm one of those guys who goes around and asks and looks and complains. And I don't see enough American-made products on the shelf. In the last 4 or 5 years, I'm seeing more labels with an American-made label, and some of those products are starting to come back. but it's not enough. We need in this country another 30% of our working age and able-bodied Americans employed. When our people are employed, we can work with the world and have more to sell to the world.
Well, the boulder will have moved on if you don't balance the thing on the way. Yes, we need to employ more Americans, and yes, made in America is a wonderful thing. I don't have any problem with that. But, it's all a question of balance. And I think if you trash the NAFTA, somebody else is going to step in and America's going to lose out. Renegotiate it by all means, but scrapping it is, there's, for instance, Boeing falsely claimed that Bombardier, the Canadian aircraft manufacturer, was getting subsidies. Well, guess what? Boeing gets subsidies too, because for the first thing, they don't buy any foreign-made defense equipment. Boeing has those, and McDonnell Douglas has it all added to them on a plate. If you occasionally bought tankers from Airbus, that would be different, but they, because of American nativism, they cancel that order. So, it is a two-way street, and this world has been a two-way street since World War II because we won it. And places today are thriving in Asia and in Europe and everything is because we defeated nationalism and nativism. And if we want to import it into this country now, it's going to be a disaster.
Yeah, right.
Well, that's where I would take exception with you. I think we agree on more than we disagree, Bruce, and I really appreciate your calling and sharing your views. And I want to thank you for all the work you do helping small businesses and helping them export. And I don't know exactly what you do, but I'm sure it's good work. And your heart is definitely in the right place. Just a few things to go. We agree on more than we disagree on. Nobody is suggesting we trash trade agreements and we stop trading and we go back to a state that Japan was in before Admiral Perry and the black ship showed up in Tokyo Harbor in 1856. Nobody is suggesting that. We want exactly what you say. The word is balance. Right now, American goods being shipped into China face 20% tariffs. The Chinese government has taken a very, very strong buy China approach. They are seeking to develop national champion industries. They target specific industries for takeover on a global scale, just as Japan did. They want a steel industry. They want an electronics industry. They want to climb the value chain of not simply, they started by making things for foreign brands. They took over the footwear industry. They took over a big chunk of the textile and garment industry. Now they want to have their own brands. They're now requiring that technology be transferred to Chinese corporations and research and development be done in China. These are the policies that we need to have. If it's good for China, it's good for the United States. Is sauce for the goose, is sauce for the gander. We want balance. If we face 20% tariffs selling into the Chinese market, well then, Chinese goods should see a 20% tariff selling into the U.S. market. If they don't like that, they can drop their tariffs against our goods. The Chinese government is looking out, as it should, for what's good for the Chinese people. I merely suggest humbly that the American government do the same for the American people. Do what's good for the American people, not what's good for the Fortune 50 and the people who live at 38,000 feet in the first class cabin flying to Davos. That's who the government needs to be looking out for, the American people. Now, it's nice to see McDonald's all over the world and to see Procter & Gamble goods on the shelves all over the world. I have no problem with that. You will probably find that those Procter & Gamble goods are made in those other countries. When you find Procter & Gamble goods on the shelves in Europe and in Latin America, they're being produced in Latin America. They're being produced in Europe. The McDonald's is using beef that's grown in Europe, that's grown in Latin America.
I mean, that's a truism.
And that's good. That's a good thing. I have no problem with that. But how about we do that here? How about the McDonald's that sells McDonald's on 42nd Street in Manhattan uses American beef instead of using beef grown in Mexico? Maybe that's an idea. Maybe we start with there. The Welch's grape juice, the grapes are from other countries. It is very hard to – the apple juice, and the apple juice is used as a sweetener in many other products, is all from China. The people in upstate New York that grow apples are being killed. The grapes – Welch's, by the way, started in western New York on the shores of Lake Erie. They're being destroyed by imported cheap imported grape juice concentrate and apple juice concentrate from other countries. So we look and we see food on the shelves here, but we have to ask where it comes from. Maybe that's a good thing. Maybe it's a bad thing. But and you have to look under the hood and see, are these goods being subsidized by the foreign governments in order to capture market share on a global scale?
Well, some of it's true, and you're right, that people in Vietnam are certainly getting subsidies from their governments, a small country. But there is a huge demand for U.S. products and U.S. culture out in the world. And that's
yay! That's a great thing.
That is part of what's happening. But these countries have grown up and become viable partners for the U.S. largely because of free trade, largely because we've... if they weren't partners of the United States in free trade, look at what's happening in Syria. Look at what's happening in the Middle East. These countries were never partners in the global
Bruce,
alliance, and they've fallen apart.
Curtis, Larkin, Mark, and Rich. I hate to say, our time has come to an end. But Curtis, it's again been an unbelievable program. I've been introduced to so many things today. I can't get over it. Remember, everybody, that November is Made in America Month, and we will be promoting that during next weekend's broadcast, this coming weekend, as well as on Wednesday of next week. Please do support your local stores, and we'll have a rebroadcast of today's program out on the net in a few hours. Please do spread the word. Thank you all for joining us until this Saturday at 11 or next Wednesday at 11. My very best to all of you. Thanks for tuning in and thanks for being part of this outstanding broadcast.
Thank you, Curtis, and thank you, Bruce, for very good, spirited discussions. I love that.
Thanks, guys.
Bye.